Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, it's Michael Kelly and John Hancock sitting in for Mark Reardon. Mark's out the rest of the week, but no worry. Somebody will be in here to visit with
Bo
you, Mark.
Matthews.
Is that who's coming
That's exactly who it is.
John, it's hard to believe that 19 years ago today, Governor Carnahan, his son Randy, and his aide, Chris Siffert, perished in that terrible train or plane crash in Jefferson County. We're going to be joined on the Quiver River Electric guest line by a good friend of mine, and I think a good friend of yours.
Indeed.
His name is Roy Temple. Roy was a political strategist. He's based in Kansas City. He ran Governor Carnahan's 1996 reelection campaign and was the senior advisor for his 2000 U.S. Senate campaign. Roy, thanks for joining us and our condolences to you on this terrible day.
Well, thanks, guys. It's good to be with you. But as you know, it's a tough day for those of us who were close to the Carnahan family and to Chris. So I appreciate your kind words.
Well, it was we all know about that day and just the terrible circumstances and the incredible outpouring of love that took place after that. And often we focus on Governor Carnahan, and I want to talk about Governor Carnahan's legacy in a second, but both Randy and Chris were really good friends of yours. I believe Chris came from the same hometown as you, right?
Yeah. When Chris and I were growing up in Puxico, Missouri, population 833, the statistical odds of both of us ending up working in the governor's office at the same time had to approach zero. But yeah, we grew up five houses apart in Puxico, and worked together on campaigns, and he went off to work as a reporter in Springfield, and then I kind of recruited him back to the Carnahan campaign during the primary, and we both worked for Mel for another decade thereafter, basically, in various configurations.
Often we talk about what happened after the death of Mel Carnahan, and that's, of course, he winds up winning the election against John Ashcroft. Mrs. Carnahan then goes on to be the United States Senator. But Mel Carnahan's impact and legacy in the state of Missouri is really deep-rooted. Talk a little bit about the impact and legacy of Mel Carnahan.
Well, look, I think Governor Carnahan had a lot to be proud of. I remember just a few days before the crash, we were going over some of the statistics, you know, in preparation for the debates with then-Senator Ashcroft. And we were going through some of the statistics of different metrics that had changed over the course of his time. And I just remember the look of kind of pride on his face, because we were talking about things about how, you know, we had instituted, you know, full day kindergarten in places that didn't have it across the state. We saw graduation rates rising. We saw immunization rates rising. We had seen statistics on violent crime decreasing. We had seen, you know, many people will know the controversial tussles Governor Carnahan got into the legislature over anti-choice legislation. But Governor Carnahan also was the first governor to put state funding into family planning. And in fact, abortion rates in Missouri had declined over the course of his tenure. He raised taxes to pay for education very early in his term, but over the course of the 8 years he was governor, taxes actually decreased by $650 million. So he had a lot to be proud of, and he was, but he was a guy that didn't focus a lot about bragging about what he'd done. He was always kind of focused on what next could be done, and that's kind of how he lived his life.
Really one of the most successful Democratic politicians in Missouri history when you look at the run that he had. His father had been a congressman from Missouri, and Mel Carnahan, following in his father's footsteps, he served in the legislature. He was the state treasurer. He was the lieutenant governor, elected governor twice. You know, this was a very accomplished politician. We're visiting with Roy Temple, who was a senior advisor on that campaign in 2000 when the plane crash went down 3 weeks before the election. I, at that time, was the executive director of the Missouri Republican Party. And you'll remember, Roy, that that was a very, very contentious race between Ashcroft and Carnahan, and the polls were absolutely neck and neck and had been really throughout. And things had gotten kind of nasty as you wind into the home stretch. My most vivid memory of that night, the Cardinals were playing the Mets in the playoffs, and I was watching the game. I was at home having dinner, and I got the page. My pager went off. That's how long ago this was. And I went into the office, and we learned what had happened. And my first thought was just the horror of it all. My second thought was, we had some very hard-hitting direct mail that was going out that night to hit the post office. And I spent about a half an hour to an hour getting in touch with those truck drivers and literally pulling the direct mail trucks off the highway to keep them from dropping that at the post office overnight. There were just, you know, it's the kind of thing you never expect in a campaign. On a personal level, where were you? How did you hear the news?
Well, I was actually in New Madrid waiting for the plane because we were doing an event in New Madrid with a group of African-American ministers down there. And I was down there waiting for them to arrive. And Chris had called me and said that there was weather and that instead of coming to Jefferson or coming to New Madrid, they were going to have to go to Jefferson City instead. They were rerouting. And so I waited a while and I said, called and left a voicemail for Chris and said, hey, when you land, give me a call and I'll put you on a speakerphone. And, you know, you can have the governor say, sorry, couldn't make it because of weather. And enough time went by, and I hadn't heard back from Chris that I was wondering what had happened. So I called the mansion and asked Sergeant Maxey, who was running the desk there, if they had arrived in Jefferson City. And he said, well, no, they weren't coming here. They were going to New Madrid. And I said, well, they rerouted. He said, uh-oh. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we heard that there was a plane missing, but it wasn't on the route that we thought they were on. So then from there, it sprang to action, and we quickly determined that it was, in fact, the governor's plane. And then, you know, because we were so close to my hometown, and once obviously we knew what the outcome before the public did, and we had to, you know, wait to confirm things until everybody appropriately had been notified. So I actually drove from Madrid to Puxico. I called Chris's brother and told him to go to his dad's house, turn off the TV, and wait for me to get there. And so I actually drove to Puxico and was the one that told Chris's dad what had happened. So it was tough on many, many levels. You know, just an odd set of circumstances, for sure.
Roy, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to visit with us. I know 19 years later, it still hurts on a daily basis. Yep. We all send our sympathies and condolences to you and the entire Carnahan operation and the Sifford family. And I'm grateful for you taking a couple of minutes.
You bet. It's good to talk to you guys. Wish we were on a happier topic. I'm sure we'll do it again
sometime. We will do it again indeed. Roy Temple.
Well, a classy guy and a tragic time, John. I was just a young pup starting in politics. If you remember, the debates were going to be taking place at Wash U the next night.
Right.
Al Gore and George W. Bush were going to have their debate at Washington University. And Mr. Gore was to have a rally at my dad's office there at the Carpenter's Hall. And I'll never forget my father calling me. I lived in Brentwood, Missouri, and saying, hey, we got a bad situation. And so we wound up canceling that.
Where were you working then?
I was working for the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, okay.
And things just began to spiral from then. And the days after that plane crash, one, were an incredible tribute to Mel Carnahan. I'll never forget that funeral. Of course, you had the president of the United States,
right.
The vice president, John Ashcroft. Everyone was there. Robin Carnahan wound up giving a speech that I think will forever be cemented into the minds of those of us that pay attention to politics in Missouri, where she said, her dad always said, don't let the fire go out. And it took on a whole life of its own. And then, of course, Mr. Carnahan goes on to win the election. What was that word?
Posthumously.
Posthumously. And she goes to serve in the United States Senate. It was a crazy couple of days there here in Missouri. And it's still sad every year when this comes up because often we hear about stuff like this that happens in other places. And, I mean, I know Roy Temple. He's a friend of mine. This was one of his best friends. Lived five doors down from him, his childhood friend who died in that plane crash. And you know the Carnahans. You knew them. You fought bitterly against them, but had respect for them. And it's just an overwhelming emotion that comes every year.
It's one of those moments in your life I will never forget. The unfolding of those events, you know, and exactly. I still remember what I was having for dinner and watching the car. I was actually keeping score. That's what a dork I am. I was keeping score of the Cardinals game. They were playing the Mets in the playoffs. And and then, you know, the unfolding of those events, I'll never forget it.
Well, there was a debate going to happen the day after that plane crash, but there was also a debate last night, John Hancock. The Democrats debated. On CNN last night.
12 of them up there.
We're going to talk a little bit about the debates. We're going to parse out who the winners are, the losers are, and we've got some sound bites.
We're going to tell you what's going to happen when we come back right here on KVOX.
One, two.
Two for two.
It's Hancock and Kelly on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Well, I tortured myself last night and stuck with the Cardinal game all the way to the end, John Hancock. I read on Twitter that you gave up on the Cardinals, I think, in the third inning?
That would right around in there, yes.
And you wound up flipping over to the Democratic debate.
I did.
I'll confess I did not watch the debate. Of course, I watched all the clips that came afterwards, and it appears as though there were three big winners. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg did pretty well for themselves.
Amy Klobuchar wasn't bad.
Joe Biden, kind of just treading water. I am a supporter of Joe Biden myself. I think he had some good moments. He also had some moments that were troublesome. He seems to be stuck on some words. He's got all the information in his brain, but getting it out.
I hate to tell you this, Michael, but he's in trouble. And he's down to $8 million cash on hand, and which is, you know, that's kind of reminiscent. You may recall in 2008 the McCain campaign. They spent all their money. They fired all their staff. It looked like that campaign was over. But then they brought it all back, and by the time the nomination rolled around, he won. So there is that precedent for Joe Biden. But he's just not doing well. And I got to tell you, man, I think this Hunter Biden stuff has hurt him.
Well, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and the way now they're kind of going back and Hunter's pulling himself out of these affiliations, saying, I'm not going to do that again. I mean, it's an admission that at best that was sloppy.
It definitely appears as though the vice president is running to stand still. He, of course, started out the gate with all the name recognition and all the support. He hasn't really lost a lot of that support, but others have surged.
Yeah.
Who are those others? Bernie Sanders, who a week ago, I think I was sitting with you saying that this untimely heart situation was maybe going to be problematic for him. But he had a really good evening last night.
Yeah,
and then,
Bernie.
Of course, you have Elizabeth Warren, who...
She's the front runner.
Yeah, who's not my favorite candidate, but I have to tell you, I believe is running the best campaign on the Democratic side.
So my favorite time, you know, I don't remember... Remember Jurassic Park, Kelly, in the day? Mm-hmm. You had the Tyrannosaurus Rex out there running around. You had the Stegosaurus over here. Mm-hmm. And they would fight with each other.
Right.
Well, we got to see a little bit about that last night. The two dinosaurs in the field, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, they got into a little... Tit for tat.
I'm going to say something that is probably going to offend some people here, but I'm the only one on the stage that's gotten anything really big done.
You talked about working with Republicans and getting things done. But you know what you also got done? And I say this as a good friend. You got the disastrous war in Iraq done. You got a bankruptcy bill, which is hurting middle-class families all over this country. You got trade agreements like NAFTA and PNTR with China done, which have cost us 4 million jobs.
Doesn't sound like a guy who was in the hospital less than 48 hours ago, does it?
No, they were. That was something else. And now, I don't think Bernie's a serious threat to win this nomination. But, you know, he certainly is carrying the banner. You know, there's a very real sense, and they're not coming from the same place. But the messaging of a Bernie Sanders and an Elizabeth Warren is at its fundamental core a populist message. And there's a sense in which they're almost a mirror image in some ways of Donald Trump.
True.
And the kind of appeal they have to the disenfranchised, to the outsider, to the anti-establishment, the only question is how big that component is of the Democratic electorate. We're going to find out over the next several months as this thing rolls on.
Well, and obviously some of the hot topics of the day were on tap there last night, and we've got some sound related to them.
Yeah, the good old Liz, she wants to have Medicare for all. She wants to get rid of private health insurance, and here was a little of that.
Let me be clear on this. Costs will go up for the wealthy. They will go up for big corporations and for middle class families. They will go down.
A yes or no question that didn't get a yes or no answer. Look, this is why people here in the Midwest are so frustrated with Washington in general and Capitol Hill in particular. Your signature, Senator, is to have a plan for everything except this.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this and that taxes are going to go up. And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but you have not said that. And I think we owe it to the American people to tell them where we're going to send the invoice.
I have made clear what my principles are here, and that is costs will go up for the wealthy and for big corporations and for hardworking middle class families. Costs will go down.
Well, Elizabeth Warren starting to get some of that front-runner treatment. That was Amy Klobuchar hopping in there to help beat up on Elizabeth
Warren. $34 trillion over 10 years is what this thing costs, Kelly. And that's a conservative estimate. And in the process of spending $34 trillion over 10 years, you're taking the private insurance that people have away from them. And I think this is going to be a big electoral problem if Elizabeth Warren is your nominee.
And is it a problem inside the Democratic Party as well? Sherrod Brown, a guy who gets elected in a Republican state.
And a liberal.
And a liberal has been very vocal that this Medicaid for all is not something that's going to sell to the industrial Midwest when you're outlawing private health care. And so the Democrats are really fighting for the soul of what the Democratic Party is going to stand for.
You think about one of the core constituencies of the Democratic Party is the labor movement.
Absolutely.
And
it's one of the benefits of being in a labor union.
The labor unions have a hallmark for going and delivering the best health care for their members. It's part of what they do. It's part of what makes them relevant and vibrant. And when you take that away, you're causing a rupture there.
So let's break this down, you and I, just looking into our crystal balls. Yep. I think Joe Biden's going to be able to stick around to see until he starts to lose. He's definitely going to make it to Iowa. There's no doubt about it. Elizabeth Warren's going to make it to Iowa. Bernie doesn't seem to ever stop. He's going to have his 20% that's always with him. Is there room for one more? Is it Pete Buttigieg, who had a great night, has a real problem in some of the base vote areas of the Democratic Party?
Well, he's not real popular with African Americans, and that I think that's a disqualifier as a Democratic nominee.
Kamala Harris, who came out of the box
big, huge
fundraising. Also facing some opposition from African Americans.
Yeah, and you're seeing the money starting to dry up. The key thing to keep your eye on, and I was shocked at Bernie's money situation. I really was. Biden's money situation. Bernie raises money well. Warren's raising good money. Buttigieg is raising money well. If Biden can't keep up in the money race, I don't know, man. He may make it to Iowa, but I don't know how deep he can run on this thing if he runs out of dough and he can't replenish his coffers.
Well, it's hard to believe the vice president to Barack Obama, arguably the most popular Democratic president we've had in decades, is unable to raise money.
Well, it's, you know, running for president is so fundamentally different than any other campaign. And these folks that have these high burn rates, they're spending the money and they've got their overstaffed, they're layered in staff. You know, you've got a regional director, you've got a state director, they're reporting to somebody. It doesn't appear to be a very lean machine that has been built over there. And that's a real problem the campaigns run into. And if that's what's plaguing Joe Biden, he's got to fix that right now.
There's no doubt about it. Hey, he's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. When we come back, we're going to visit with CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. I bet he's got some opinions and thoughts about what the president's up to in Syria. All of that and more right after this on KMOX.
We've got football. Thursday night, it's the Chiefs and Broncos. And you can hear it here, pregame at 7. On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Well, we're all aware of the president pulling out of Syria and leaving our Kurdish allies sitting ducks. Joining us on the Quiver River Electric guest line is CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, welcome back to KMOX.
Hey, it's always a great pleasure to be with you guys.
The Congress today voted 354-60 in an unbelievable bipartisan fashion to condemn the president's removal of the troops from Syria. This seems to have come out of the middle of nowhere that the president pulled these troops out. Was there no indication anywhere in the military or inside Congress that this is what the president was going to be up to?
Well, no, the president brought this up before. Don't forget, back in December of 2018, the president made a similar sort of sudden announcement, which precipitated the resignation at the time in a very stunning letter of resignation by then Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. And he kind of reversed himself. We had about 2,000 troops in Syria at that time. So what the Pentagon did, many people thought they were kind of placating the boss, was they cut the size of the force in half to about 1,000 through May of 2019, but still maintained those forces strategically located up there along the border, and then made some discussion that a future date we'd see the balance of U.S. forces removed. So there had been some, you know, some talking about this, but this the suddenness of this particular decision, particularly for these forces, 50 to 100, that were right there on the border, who in many ways were serving to stabilize the situation to the point of even actually negotiating for the Kurds to remove some fortifications, heavy weaponry, in an effort to dampen down tension with the Turks, doing some joint patrolling with the Turks to reduce tensions. But then this precipitate announcement of we're going to pull out just gave Erdogan the green light, and I think all of us would agree chaos has ensued.
And speaking of chaos, are the troops, the American troops that the president says he's pulling out, who I guess are in the process of pulling out, do we know them to be safe right now?
To the best of my knowledge, we do not. And one of the problems is the advance of the Turks has been so rapid, they have actually cut some road networks, which we would have to use for our withdrawal, which would physically by ground be out through Iraq. Secretary of Defense Esper has even talked about it might take 30 days to get everybody out. A desire to withdraw equipment as well as just physically withdrawing troops, and they're in a pretty tough spot. I mean, here you've got the Turks on one side, and part of those Turkish groups are paramilitary groups, which are not nearly as well disciplined, quite frankly, as Turkish regular forces. You got at one time our Kurdish friends, but I'm sure they're not exactly looking very nicely upon those Americans who are the representation of the abandonment they feel they have suffered. And now we've got the arrival of the Syrian army from Damascus, because our former friends have cut a deal with Damascus and well as the Russians, who are terribly concerned about the safety of Americans. There has even been some discussion plans might be on foot to air evacuate some of our troops out of areas where they might well be, which would cause us to abandon very expensive equipment and look pretty demoralizing to see Americans retreat, if you will, with their tail between their legs out of this particular area.
The president of the United States, obviously the commander-in-chief, he can do what he chooses. Is he getting any private pushback from military leadership that's giving it to him there in the Situation Room or in the White House?
Well, I don't know for certain, but God, I hope so. I mean, we have new chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, who's supposed to be a pretty straight-talking Army general, and I hope General Miley is the voice for that. And we've certainly seen a number of military officers anonymously who are in the region or involved in the region say that they are totally ashamed of what we are, in fact, doing to these allies that we've fought alongside of for the last 4 or 5 years. And we've had more than our share of very senior officers who have since retired, most notably Joe Votel, who was a good friend of mine and a former commander of CENTCOM and involved in the defeat of ISIS for those many years, saying that he, too, thinks this is somewhat disgraceful for the United States to leave our Turkish allies, or some sure, our Kurdish allies, forgive me, sort of high and dry. We make this sudden decision to depart.
We are visiting with CBS military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, a great expert. We loved to have you on, Jeff. So, you know, the idea that America shouldn't be engaged in all these places all over the world, kind of the president's, I would argue, simplistic view of pulling our troops out and doesn't, I think, appreciate the fact that when the U.S. leaves, something much worse moves into that vacuum, and here we are. And here we have Russians, Syrians, Iranians, all engaged in this thing and zero U.S. presence. And at this point, zero U.S. allies in that place. This can't end well, can it?
This, to my mind, verges on catastrophic because you put your finger on it. So far, this has benefited certainly the Turks. They're getting what they want. It has benefited the Russians because now all the countries in the region say, well, the Russians are the major power because the United States has left that we're going to turn to. It has certainly benefited President Assad in Damascus because he's wanted to move back in this area since his troops departed in 2012. They are returning. It has benefited Iran, who has looked for some mechanism, some area that it can ensure they can move equipment and weapons across Syria to support Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. That now has been opened up to them. And all these countries are now going to cooperate and encouraged to work together to undermine any sanctions the United States might place upon them. But think about U.S. credibility abroad. You know, the great Senator Roy Blount from the great state of Missouri said today, as part of these discussions on Capitol Hill, well, you know, the Turks are not reliable allies, and the Kurds certainly were reliable allies. And I totally agree with Senator Blount. But I'd like to ask the following question, Senator Blount. Who thinks the United States is a reliable ally? As you look beyond the region, does anybody in Korea or Japan or perhaps the government of Afghanistan or perhaps a NATO Eastern European ally look upon this as the United States walks away from an ally that shed up to 11,000 of its soldiers who were killed fighting ISIS, that now the United States, under this administration at least, is a credible, reliable ally that they can depend on?
Yeah, I mean, how do you think Georgia and Latvia are feeling these days? You know, this is a major departure. And you listed off the winners of this thing, Russia, Syria, Iran. But ISIS is a winner in this process.
Absolutely. You're 100,000% correct. I mean, there's about 70,000 detainees in Syria. About 11,000 of those are fighters, rest are family members and the like that have been controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces that we supported. There's clear evidence that many of those fighters are escaping from prisons because they're either in the area where the offensive is under ongoing, or the Syrian Democratic Forces that were securing those particular areas are now being moved up to the front. And I found it, frankly, demoralizing that when the president was asked about this morning, his response was, well, you know, they're just releasing those fighters to make me look bad. Yeah. Not that it was bad for the United States, not that it was bad for the war on terrorism. It was making him look bad personally.
We just have about a minute left. It's pretty obvious at this point that there are war crimes being committed by the Turks and their allies in northern Syria. Now, there's an ethnic cleansing operation. At least that's the goal of Turkey as it relates to the Kurds, has been for a very long time. And our relationship with Turkey clearly is going to suffer as a result of this. So before we let you go, the United States is sitting on a nuclear arsenal in Turkey. Right. What becomes of that, and how serious is that situation?
That's positively quite explosive, no pun intended. I mean, formally, the Turks are still a member of NATO. There is no mechanism to boot them out because it takes a unanimous vote, and they would probably veto that. But their relationship with NATO at the moment is strained. Part of that alliance, you're right, and I've written a book about this, quite frankly, is the presence of roughly 50 tactical nuclear weapons at Incirlik Air Force Base in southern Turkey. These are really, in many ways, left over from the Cold War mission back in the days when we had thousands of weapons across our NATO ally partners across the region. These weapons are under U.S. control, but in some cases, in wartime, might be transferred for delivery by a Turkish, German, Italian, or Dutch ally in the process. There was some suggestion during the aborted coup back in 2016 that was a moment we should consider removing them. That was not done, but they are there today. And as one observer said, it's the first time in history where the United States had nuclear weapons on a country's territory while that same country was firing artillery at our forces.
Unbelievable.
Clearly, there's a lot of discussion in the Pentagon about what we do about that.
Unbelievable. Well, as always, Jeff, great insight. Thank you so much. We're up against it on time, but we'll talk more about this later.
Thanks, my friend.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Indeed, the audio cut of the day is sponsored by the Good Feet Store. Pain relief and comfort to fit any budget. Well, today marks the 19th anniversary of the tragic death of Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, killed in a plane crash in Jefferson County. KMOX's Kevin Killeen talked with longtime Capitol correspondent Phil Brooks about that night.
Joining me now is longtime KMOX Jefferson City Bureau Chief Phil Brooks, who covered it from Jeff City the night that Mel Carnahan's plane went down. And Phil, I remember I was at home. The news day was over for me when I got the call. It was a rainy night that the governor's plane at first was missing in a thunderstorm. And then I was sent out to the area of Goldman, Missouri, where the plane had gone down. And I remember the yellow leaves on the black top of the little windy roads and the highway patrol trooper cars lined up, parked along farm fields. And from their demeanor, you could tell that they weren't getting the answers they were hoping for. At first, they were hoping they would find survivors. But you found out on your end, at what time in Jefferson City that evening did you gather that the governor had died?
Oh, golly, it was late in the evening. The Secretary of State that he had appointed, Becky Cook, came in to the basement garage. We realized this was late in the evening, and she was in tears. She was a dear friend of Mel Carnahan, and that was telling me, golly, she's a member of the disability board that declares the governor unable. And then Mel Carnahan's spot got taken by Roger Wilson, the lieutenant governor.
His parking
with
spot.
Highway Patrol security staff. The only person who parks in that spot is the governor. The only person who has Highway Patrol security is the governor or his family. That just yelled to me, Mel Carnahan is no longer with us.
I remember then the next morning, did you stay up the whole night? Because I got about 2 hours sleep in the news truck outside the Goldman, Missouri fire station where I did live reports the next morning about the governor's death. Did you get any sleep that night heading into the next news morning?
I didn't get any sleep for the next three nights after Mel Carnahan's death, literally. This was, for me, probably the most difficult, time-consuming, and emotional thing I've covered in my life.
That's Jefferson City Bureau Chief Phil Brooks for KMOX. I'm Kevin Killeen on this 19th anniversary of the fatal plane crash that took the life of Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan.
Well, sobering reminder of the play that took place there as Roger Wilson became governor.
Yep.
He later had a meeting with all of the statewides. I guess there's some constitutional provision that requires them to vote. You know, I don't think it's a big secret. Maybe I'm letting it out. I don't know that Mel Carnahan and Roger Wilson were the best of friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, Roger Wilson, you talk about really unique circumstances. A man who carried himself with some dignity and class and compassion during that time is something that shouldn't be lost.
Roger Wilson, I served. He was a state senator when I was in the House. And a more talented politician you will not find. He was a glad hander. Everybody liked him. And he was long thought to be the future of the Democratic Party. And so he's the sitting governor and wanted very much to run for the full term, at some point. And, when Carnahan got into the Senate race, the governor's seat was opened up, and he wanted to run for governor and really got muscled out by the folks supporting Bob Holden. A lot of those were the Carnahan people, and I think that's kind of what caused some of that tension.
Yeah, Carnahan and Gephardt. Bob Holden
right.
Put up some huge fundraising
exactly.
Quarters, and no dough, no go in politics. And But Roger Wilson carried himself with incredible class.
He did. I always liked Roger.
How can you not?
Good guy. Well, he's Michael Kelly. I'm John Hancock. It is time for Total Information PM. We'll get a check on traffic right after this on KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.